More skilled, more dangerous than your average rent-a-cop. Not bad. Not terribly clever, but credible. He continued to circle her as she painstakingly dragged herself, shuddering and uncoordinated, inch by inch across a floor shimmering like a frozen sea under the potlights. At times, the plane of quartz seemed to tilt precariously, so that she feared sliding at increasing velocity until she pitched across some brink, into a melt-smoothed vent flume that would spin her down. She was already dizzy, down into deep and deeper ice caverns. "From the get-go," Coy said, "my job was to establish the air of conspiracy and paranoia that would thicken and become complicated event by event. But that's about all I was given to do. Except, of course, to be a distraction. To pop up when perhaps your thinking leads you toward the thing you find unthinkable." The Sig Sauer lay inches away, frozen to the tilted ice field and thus resistant to the gravity that would have sent it spinning away from her. She reached for it with her right hand, which was coming under her control again. Coy had clicked a third cartridge into the taser, and he fired it into her back. The probes, which could bite through an inch of clothing, pierced her blazer and t-shirt with no difficulty, serpent fangs injecting a current similar to that of the human body. Technomavens called it neuromuscular incapacitation, a solemn laboratory term for a total physical freakout, the baffled brain no longer able to discern the difference between the body's natural signals and the storm of meaningless static. But the effect was more visceral and more emotional than the dry term suggested. With each shock, Bibi was thrown into a cold, rushing river of sensation, at the same time that she was robbed of any ability to control her reaction to it. And she wondered if, with the fourth cartridge, or the fifth, she would soil her pants and have the last shreds of dignity stripped from her. Coy kicked the pistol away from Bibi's spasming fingers. The weapon spun beyond her blurred and salt-stung vision. "Are you listening to me, woman?" Coy asked, booming at her as if he were a lowercase god of the elements, speaking in the language of thunder, and she were a groveling penitent. "Think about my name. Chub is as frivolous as Bibi, don't you think? Yeah, sure, I'm being used to distract you, but part of me, just like part of you, wants you to find the truth. To be freed by the truth." There was a metallic taste in Bibi's mouth. Not the familiar coppery flavor of blood, she hadn't bitten her tongue, but more like sucking on rusted iron. And a bitter lump rose in her throat, either vomit or self-pity. Her flesh stiffened, even as her bones seemed to have been reduced to jelly, quivering like aspic on a plate. "I am restricted. You have restricted me to only indirect means of breaking through the stubborn and resistant Bibi, to reach the other Bibi that wants to remember the full truth. And so I try to make you understand what I really am by speaking out of character. Are you listening to me, Gidget?" She thought that she said yes. "What did you say?"
"Yes."
"Yes, what?"
"I'm listening, yes." She heard the susurrant syllables hissing from her lips and across the quartz. "Yes," he said.
"I tried to make you understand by speaking out of character. Chub Coy, former homicide detective, not known to have significant interest in the classics of American literature. Jack London, Thornton Wilder, Flannery O'Connor. They all just happen to be among your admired pantheon. Are you listening, Gidget?"
"Yes," she whispered.
"Listening isn't the same as hearing," he declared.
And with the cruel authority of a stone temple god armed with modern technology, he slammed her with a fourth taser cartridge. She didn't black out. She didn't soil her pants either. But she didn't feel like searching for the lost gun, or like doing anything other than lying on the bright griddle of quartz, melting like a pat of butter. His voice remained stern, but softer than before.
I try to alert you to what I am. You sabotage me. Sabotage yourself with the memory trick.
She was looking at his shoes, inches from her face. They were Gucci loafers. They shouldn't be Gucci loafers. Too expensive for him. Too effete. He walked a few circuits around her, saying nothing. His socks were right. Not fancy designer socks with elaborate patterns. Plain black. A blend of man-made fabrics with just a little cotton. He could have bought them at Walmart. Good working cop socks. He said,
Would you really rather die than learn the truth of what you are?
No.
What did you say? No. I don't want to die. Say it like you mean it. I don't want to die.
After a silence, with pity that had an edge of contempt, he said,
Then prove it by dealing with me.
She was lying prostrate, head turned to the right. The injured left side of her face pressed against the stone floor. Her bleeding ear began to burn and throb again as the chaotic effect of the latest tasering wore off and coherent messaging returned to her nervous system.
Proving yourself to yourself doesn't mean you'll survive,
Coy said.
You could still easily end up dead or insane. But dealing with me is a start. Deal with me.
Lying in the reception hall of a building in which a new world of fascist fury was being designed, she thought about what needed to be done. Editing. Revision. From behind her came a rustle, a couple of soft thumps, as if some length of drapery had slipped off a rod, though the room had no draperies. She waited. She listened. She heard nothing more. When, with an effort, Bibi sat up and turned her head, she saw Chubkoy's discarded shoes and clothing, a puddle of fabric in the jumble of which his shoulder holster and pistol and taser could be seen. He seemed to have disrobed and disarmed and walked off naked, though she had heard no door open or close. Earlier, in the motel, studying the London, O'Connor, and Wilder quotations, she had begun to realize not only that Chubkoy had spoken out of character, but also that he was a character. One of her creation. The quest for Ashley Bell would have collapsed right there if she hadn't cut the words from the books and burned them in the bathroom sink, using the memory trick to preserve this world, which was now too fully formed to easily dissolve. To an observer, she might have appeared defeated as she crawled on her hands and knees to the tall black granite desk and sat on the floor with her back against its polished slab front. She had lost her baseball cap, her hair tumbled in disarray. If her battered face was as pale as her hands, pale almost to ash gray, she must have looked at once weak and wild. She wasn't weak, however, and wild only to the extent that she didn't know what jungles waited within her or what powers, native to them, she would soon discover. She was not defeated. But she was in the cold grip of fright. Chapter 121. The Captain Regrets. Pax and Pogo stood with Bibi's parents, arrayed around her bed, watching her shudder and twitch under the bedclothes, as her exposed hands, palsied and plucking, seemed to flick something offensive from her fingertips, as though washing through the room were currents of stinging power that only she could feel. The bizarre display alarmed Nancy to tears, but Murphy withheld the nurse call button from her. Although no less distressed than his wife, he remained in the thrall of father's intuition, convinced that his daughter was for the moment not in danger, but instead that in essence, in mind and soul, she occupied a mysterious place more real than dreams and safer than the depths of coma. The shaking and erratic movements subsided, and then faded away completely. She lay quiet and composed. The cardiac monitor, which had recorded a mild increase in her heartbeat, now reported an equally mild decrease. As during the episode, the five brainwaves continued pumping at optimal strength and in optimal patterns. Having heard the contents of the microcassette, Pax and Pogo had more reason than Murphy to believe that his hope was rational. They also had good reason to fear there was a mortal threat to Bibi that came from within herself, that perhaps no other human being had ever faced. They recounted the salient points of their day. The lockbox, and the items in it other than the tape, including the dog collar bearing the name Jasper. The visit to Dr. St. Croix. The reason Bibi had been forced out of the writing program. The Panther and Gazelle notebook. The lines of Bibi's handwriting that appeared before their eyes. The visit to Toba Ringelbaum. The identity of Ashley Bell. A fictional character based on fact, survivor of Dachau, brain cancer specialist. Nancy and Murphy were electrified by those discoveries, and more than a little mystified, full of questions and keen for answers.
"We don't have all the answers," Pogo said. "But what's on the tape? It comes at you like a fully macking behemoth. Beebs is all we thought she was, but a whole lot more."
Before playing the tape for them, Pax wanted to know about the captain, Gunther Olaf Eriksson. Nancy had been estranged from him for much of her life and had only found a way to let him back into her heart after he had become so important to Bibi. What was it that had come between Nancy and her father back in the day? From what little Pax had said upon arrival in room 456, Nancy was aware that the tape contained an explosive revelation that might forever change her understanding of both her father and her daughter. As she strove to condense a significant portion of her past into a montage of moments, she held fast to one of Bibi's limp hands. Her stare fixed sometimes on the floor, sometimes on the night pressing at the window, and sometimes on Bibi's face. But it darted often to the small tape recorder, which Pax kept in his hand as if it was too precious to put down and risk that it might be knocked to the floor, broken. Gunther had been a good man, Nancy said. Basically good. He wanted to do the right thing. The problem lay in his priorities. He was perhaps a man who should never have married, or, having married, should not have had children. Yet he'd had two daughters, Nancy and Edith. A warrior at heart, and for the right reasons, love of country and family, he signed up for one tour of duty after another, making of the Marine Corps not solely a career, but also a full life of such intensity that his domestic life as husband and father became pale to him, became like the episodes of a bland television program that he watched from time to time when war and Cold War would allow. He loved his wife and his daughters, but he lacked the language of the heart in which that love might be properly expressed. He was fluent in the language of honor and integrity and sacrifice, able to understand men who risked their lives for their country, who would die to protect a comrade in arms. But he couldn't relate as easily to a wife who loved the small things of life, the quiet details in which it was said that you could discern the meaning of existence, or to the daughters whose temperament was more like their mother's. Anyway, as children, they possessed no awareness of the dangerous nature of the world, or of the sacrifices required to keep America safe, to spare them from the horrors and deprivations that so many people in other countries endured as the given nature of existence. When Nancy's mother died in an accident, Gunther was away at war and didn't get home in time for the funeral. If he understood what his grief-stricken children needed from him, he didn't know how to give it. He seemed to be shaken, if not devastated, by his loss, but also bewildered, as though he had thought that all risk of death arose from the violence an enemy nation could wreak on his homeland, as if for him such threats as car accidents and house fires and cancer were abstractions, likely only as the consequences of enemy attack. genuinely believed that a woman's touch was required to raise two girls. And as he didn't intend to remarry, no one could ever replace your mom. The woman he had in mind was his dead wife's sister, who did indeed welcome Nancy and Edith into her home. I never felt I really knew him, Nancy said. Until he came to live in the apartment over the garage. The way he was with Bibi, well, he found the father in himself, once war no longer needed him. Her attention returned once more to the tape recorder in Pax's hand. You said he left that tape for Bibi. You're sure it's all right for us to listen?
It's not only all right, Pax said. It's essential.
Pogo agreed.
But if a nurse or anyone walks in, we switch it off. It's too big, too radical, too freaking wild to let it go beyond the four of us.
If it ever goes beyond us, that's not ours to decide. That's Bibi's call, Pax said.
He put the tape recorder on the bed as Nancy and Murphy moved closer. He pressed play. From the small speaker came a tinny but nonetheless impressive version of Captain's voice.
My sweet girl, dear Bibi, this is my apology if it turns out one is needed. I have had a few years now to think about what I did, and I am less sure than I once was that it was the right thing. I am, at times, eaten by regret. I'm talking about the frightening event that I helped you to forget, but also about the memory trick itself, which you might have forgotten not because you were made to forget it, too, but because children naturally forget so much from their early years.
Chapter 122. Bibi on the Brink. In spite of its brightness, the crypto-fascist atmosphere of the cavernous reception hall so impressed Bibi that it called to mind a passage of music from Disney's Fantasia, Night on Bald Mountain by Mussorgsky. Recovering from four taserings, she sat on the floor, her back against the black granite desk, half seriously wondering if, when the lights went out, trolls would caper in the dark and ogres rise through the quartz floor from a world below, having ascended to devour the unwary. She was uber wary. She was alert to the unfathomed dangers of being Bibi Blair. She had edited Chub Coy out of existence. His clothes and other gear had lingered behind, but they had faded away when she looked steadily at them, as if her stare could function as an eraser. She thought she must be going mad. What seemed to have happened couldn't have happened. She couldn't eliminate someone by imagining him gone. Since shortly after leaving the hospital 2 days earlier, since she had allowed Kalida Butterfly to seek hidden knowledge on her behalf, Bibi had been aware of supernatural forces at work in the world. But perhaps they hadn't been supernatural at all. Couldn't they as easily have been the delusions of a deranged mind? If Chub Coy was so little real as to be vanquished with a mere wish, wasn't it possible that Kalida, too, and Hoflein Vorschach, and the tattoo artist, and the motel clerk, and the nameless thugs, and Robert Warren Faulkner, alias Terezin, were likewise no more than phantoms caused by a disorder of the stomach, by an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese? Surely she could eliminate them by imagining them gone, if she had imagined them into existence in the first place. Derangement wouldn't necessarily be apparent to the deranged. Except that her struggle to stay free and alive during the past 48 hours, her arduous quest, and the search for Ashley Bell had been real enough, excruciatingly actual, verifiable by the myriad pains in her muscles and joints, by the hot, throbbing ache in her torn and half-crushed ear, by the alternately recurring and receding pain in her jaw, a paroxysm that flared into higher waves when she clenched her teeth or touched her bruised face. If she couldn't edit away her pain, then the people who had inflicted it, and the person whom they served, their mother-killing cult leader, had to have been real as well. Didn't they? If Robert Warren Faulkner was a figment of her imagination, so was Terezin, and so was Terezin Inc. If such a corporation didn't exist, the building in which she sat didn't exist either, other than in her fevered imagination. Studying the acre of white quartz dazzling all around her, she tried to edit the structure out of existence. Strove to revise recent events backward to the moment when she parked the Honda along Sonnemere Way, before she ventured onto the property and encountered Marissa Hofline-Vorschach. But the reception hall and the building that contained it did not dissolve. Bibi wasn't certain if the seeming permanence of the building confirmed its reality, or if, in her stubborn insistence on the reality of Terezin Inc., she resisted editing the place out of the narrative. Regarding the rules of its delusions, a deranged mind wasn't likely to be consistent. Adding to her confusion, further testing her sanity, she heard Captain speaking to her. The voice flowed into the reception hall as if from a public address system, but it must be entirely in her head, remembered or imagined.
My sweet girl, dear Bibi, this is my apology, if it turns out one is needed. I have had a few years.
She couldn't listen to this. Captain was dead. He had been dead for more than 12 years. In the months after his aneurysm, she had wanted him back. She had desperately wanted him to be alive again. She had been wrong to want such a thing. If she was unconsciously calling him back, his return would be no more right now than it would have been then.
Talking about the frightening event that I helped you to forget, but also...
She refused to listen. By listening, she would begin wanting him back. She could not want him back. Dared not. Long ago, hadn't she learned why not? Hadn't she? She struggled to her feet, leaning for a moment against the black granite desk. Then she set off across the white quartz toward a distant dark object that could be nothing other than her pistol. The captain seemed to think she might have forgotten about the memory trick. He began to tell her how it was done. She reached the pistol and picked it up and turned in a circle, surveying the enormous room, wondering what to do now. Who would come after her next? Captain kept talking. She could see his face clearly in her mind's eye. His smile. How much better things would be if Captain were alive.
No.
Room 456. Five ideal wave conditions on the EEG. Bibi walking the board somewhere. The four witnesses around the bed. The girl not sleeping, not awake, yet also both of those things, lying in the bed, existing as well in a mysterious elsewhere. From the tape recorder, the captain spoke first about the memory trick, but not about why he'd used it. Nancy's face hardened, perhaps with some of the resentment that had embittered her in the days when, as a child herself, she had felt abandoned by him.
What is he saying? That he brainwashed her?
It may have been a mistake, Pack said, but he had a reason that seemed good to him. Listen.
He knew that the next revelation would incense both Nancy and Murphy, but the greater shock would come when the captain revealed what it was that he helped the girl to forget.
The memory trick worked so well Not because I got it from a gypsy, or a 100-year-old shaman, or from any place magical, like I made it sound. It worked, because it was developed by a lot of smart people in the intelligence community. A defense against interrogation by the enemy. Once you were hypnotized and made to believe that the memory trick worked, it would work the rest of your life, whenever you needed to wipe something from your memory.
Murphy's tan had acquired a gray cast.
He hypnotized her?
Listen, Pack said.
This next part is a little tough for me, BB. It sounds worse than it is, but I knew it wouldn't harm you in any way. See, sweetie, the hypnotism works so well to support the memory trick, because the hypnotism itself is supported by a drug that puts the subject, in this case you, in a state highly receptive to hypnotic suggestion. The night I taught you the memory trick, your mom and dad were out for the evening at a concert. We had dinner in their kitchen. Chili cheese dogs and oven-baked fries. After dinner, and before we had Eskimo pies, I taught you the memory trick. The drug I mentioned was in your Coca-Cola.
Such outrage fired Nancy's face. Pax thought she might grab the recorder and throw it. He shielded it with one hand.
Just listen. Your mom and dad were out for the evening at a concert.
The voice wouldn't stop. Bibi couldn't keep it out because it came from within her. The longer that she listened, the warmer the voice sounded, the more clearly she remembered Captain, how he had protected her. She had felt safe with Captain living above the garage and looking down on the bungalow, where her bedroom window faced the courtyard, Captain up there keeping a watch over her. Bibi found herself behind the black granite desk without quite knowing how she'd gotten there. Two tall stools would allow security men or receptionists to work at the desk. She occupied neither stool. Somehow she had retreated into the knee hole, like a child seeking a refuge, a hiding place. The captain said,
I don't know what I might have done. I mean, how having a big hole in your memory might affect you over time. Too late, I realized maybe there might be some disruption of a child's psychological development. Using the memory trick when you're a grown man, that's different. Your personality is formed. But what if... God help me. I hope nothing happens. Anyway, I don't see how you could have lived and had a normal life with that memory. More than memory. With that knowledge of what had happened. Of what you could do.
Bibi realized that the moment was approaching when she would learn the central truth of the half-recovered memory. The identity of the intruder. The thing. In her bedroom when she was 5 years old. She tried to shrink farther back into the knee hole as dread overcame her, a double dread born of the fact that it was Captain making this revelation. If her imagination were inspired to a bright and terrible creativity, maybe both he and the bedroom thing would be conjured here tonight, to prowl the reception hall for the one hiding place that it provided. And what the hell did that mean? Conjured? She was no witch.
6 months after I came to live in the apartment. 8 months after your terrifying experience. You finally trusted me enough to tell me about it. You felt you couldn't tell your mom and dad that they wouldn't, well, wouldn't understand. Whether that was right or wrong, it seemed that forgetting was for the best. And there I was, with a way to make forgetting possible. A coincidence? I've never believed in them. And knowing the kind of girl you are, how fast you're growing up, I mean, in mind and heart, so wise for one so young. I suspect eventually you also won't believe in coincidences. Anyway, you told me your colorful, very wild and dark story. And stupidly, in the way that unimaginative adults can be stupid when they've long lost their sense of wonder, I tried to dismiss it as just a bad dream. So you proved it to me. No experience in war ever so terrified me as what happened there in my apartment kitchen. The purpose of this tape, which I will tell you when I give it to you, is to serve as, I don't know, as some kind of restoration of the way things might have been. As some kind of therapy for you, if it turns out I was foolish, even reckless, to help you forget what you had done, what you could do. If I was a damn fool to teach you the memory trick.
In the recess under the desk, Bibi wept for the captain. That he had suffered regret and worried about having harmed her, when in fact, his coming to live above the garage had been a great blessing. This freshening of grief to no extent displaced her fear. She felt sorrow and terror in equal measure. And though she told herself that valiant girls didn't hide from anything, that they stood up and in the open, facing threats forthrightly, she remained in the shadowed kneehole, sitting with her knees drawn up to her chest, arms wrapped around her legs, and let out a thin sound of distress when, from out of the past, Captain's voice came to her with revelations. Chapter 123. 17 years earlier. A moment in her life with books. Bibi loved the book as much as her mother had promised that she would, as much as her mother, too, had loved it when she was a little girl. Cookie's Big Adventure. Words and pictures. Bibi had graduated to books with more words a year earlier, and recently had been able to read them all by herself, without her mother narrating. She took pride in her ability to read at a level beyond her years. Cookie, who was a gingerbread cookie in the shape of a man, with chocolate drop eyes and a white icing smile, was the best character in any book that she had yet to read. He was funny and cute and eager for adventure. Cookie came to life after being baked, while cooling on the baker's tray, though why was a mystery. The author didn't say. Cookie wasn't brittle, didn't break apart easily, as you might think he would. He was supple, strong, and quick. He remained gingerbread through and through, but there was magic in him, like in Frosty the Snowman. When Cookie left the bakery and found himself in a busy city, he was so happy to explore and discover and learn. He had scary moments when a truck almost ran over him, almost smashed him to pieces, and when a hungry dog chased him. But for the most part, his adventures were exciting in a good way, and hilarious. In the week since her mother had given her the book, Bibi must have read it 1,000 times, maybe 2,000. She didn't count. Cookie sort of became her best friend. She didn't easily make friends her age. The kids in preschool were mostly boring. Aunt Edith and a few other relatives thought Bibi was different. She'd overheard them saying so to her mother. She didn't know what they meant, how she was different, and she didn't really care. If anyone had asked her, Bibi would have said that those same relatives seemed strange to her. And she could no more explain why they were strange than they seemed to be able to explain why they found her different. Then into her life came the amazing Cookie, who was different, too, with a brave heart and a daring spirit, much as Bibi wished herself to be. Cookie and Bibi, best friends forever. Between readings of the book, Bibi sometimes made up stories of her own about Cookie, his further adventures. She couldn't draw well. She didn't attempt to sketch his exploits.
but she could see them vividly in her mind, in color, full of lively action, like waking dreams. On this evening, after being put to bed and kissed goodnight, Bibi sat up again to read Cookie's Big Adventure several times by the soft light of her bedside lamp, while the muffled voices and music of the TV came to her from the living room. Maybe she dozed off, the book hugged to her chest, because when she scooched up from the pile of pillows into which she had slid, the house was quiet. Her parents had gone to sleep. She sat for a while, looking at her favorite picture of Cookie and talking to him as if he were indeed her friend and capable of listening, caring. She told him that she wished he would come to life for her, the way that he had come to life in the wonderful story. And she really did wish it, want it, need it. She could so clearly see him rising from the page of the book as he had risen from the baker's tray before setting out into the city. When the incident began, it was pure Disney. But not for long. Cookie didn't at once spring from the book and stand before her, ta-da, arms spread, sparkling with sugar or fairy dust. He didn't speak to her in a cartoon voice. No. At first, he turned his head slightly in the illustration, as if to assess Bibi more directly. He wasn't even sure it happened, that sly turn of his head. Then, Cookie winked, and Bibi's eyes widened. Cookie's smile curved into a lopsided grin. Bibi's mouth formed an O of amazement. She let out the word, O, and gasped it back in. This wasn't an interactive book. The illustrations weren't holograms that changed depending on the angle at which they were viewed. Suddenly, Cookie turned three-dimensional, while the rest of the illustration remained as it had been, and he began trying to extract himself from the two-dimensional image, which was when it wasn't quite so much a Disney moment anymore. Bibi flung the book off the bed to the floor, where it landed spine up, standing like a tent, its fanned pages thrashing as the gingerbread man struggled to be born from them. She knelt on the mattress to watch, wondering but also fearing a little, perversely delighted but somewhat alarmed, transfixed by the sight of the book when it began to clatter this way and that across the floor, as if it were the A-frame shell of a large exotic bug. Cookie was kind and funny and wouldn't harm even the hungry dog that had wanted to eat him. Nothing bad ever happened to the children in the books that Bibi read. Those kids went on great adventures with talking animals, with elves and fairies, with favorite toys come to life and silly creatures from other planets. But nothing harmed them. When Cookie was finished pulling himself from the book, he would be like Winnie the Pooh, and she would be like Christopher Robin, and they would be the best of friends. Most likely. But there was something about Cookie's lopsided smile that disturbed her. He had winked at her with one glossy chocolate eye, and that had been okay. The wink had seemed friendly, like sharing a little joke. But the smile made her think maybe they wouldn't be best friends forever. The book fell over, flopped open on the floor. The gingerbread man rose from the pages, which beat around him like furious wings. He crawled out of the book, dark and strange, and not much like the happy-go-lucky Cookie. It wasn't well-formed, a lumpy and distorted figure, which staggered to its stumpy feet with effort. Not thin like a cookie, but inches thick, 6 or 8 inches tall. Twitching, jerking, graceless. It seemed to be tormented, white lips opening wide in what might have been a silent scream, rolling its misshapen head side to side, pulling at its flesh with mitten-like hands. Flesh, Even from a distance of 8 or 10 feet, Bibi could see that this thing wasn't made of gingerbread. In the book, Cookie was made of gingerbread dough, rolled and shaped and baked. Of course, that was silly. Even though she loved the story, Bibi had known that part was totally silly. That's why magic was needed. A little Frosty the Snowman magic to make Cookie supple, strong, and quick. Bibi didn't know any magic. When she wished Cookie alive, she thought of him, if she thought at all about this part of his manifestation, as some kind of gingerbread animal. But what she got was all animal. Or it was less than an animal, elemental and primitive, as if a rotting mass of plant and animal tissue in a swamp had been lightning struck and thereby animated with something less than life itself. Still silently screaming, the thing picked up the book, which was bigger than itself, and flung it at Bibi. The whirling volume missed her but clattered against the bedside lamp, switching it off and knocking the shade askew. Bibi would have fled if the minikin that she had wished into existence hadn't been standing between her and the door. The only illumination came from the Mickey Mouse nightlight her parents had recently installed, which until now she had found embarrassing, which she had plotted to dispose of one way or another. She was a child, yes, but not a baby in need of a nightlight. She was years past being a baby. As the thing on the floor hitched out of the Mickey glow, disappearing in the shadows, Bibi didn't want to scream for help like a baby. Maybe she couldn't have cried out even if she'd wanted to, because her hard-knocking heart seemed to have risen into her throat so that she couldn't easily swallow. And when she tried to say, "Go away," to the minikin, no sound escaped her except a thin and tremulous wheeze. Besides, if her mom and dad came running, maybe they wouldn't be able to see the thing. In stories, kids were often able to see elves and fairies and all kinds of creatures that grown-ups couldn't see because grown-ups didn't believe in them. Then she would seem like a big baby. They would never stop treating her like one. Worse, the thing from the book, the terrible, not Cookie, might hurt them. It was small, evidently toothless, but it was strong for its size, considering how it flung the book. If they were hurt, the fault would lie with Bibi. They would say it wasn't her fault. It'll be what it'll be. But she knew the truth was that it would be, because she had made it be. Kneeling on the bed, she listened to the thing creeping around the room. Judging by the way it thumped and scraped and squished, she decided it was even slower and clumsier than it had first appeared to be. There was no magic in it. Maybe it was blind. It seemed unable to scream or speak, so possibly it couldn't hear either, or smell. If the only thing it could do was fumble along the baseboard, it could only find her by chance, if it wanted to find her at all. Maybe it didn't have a brain. Maybe it wasn't able to want anything, just a stupid lump of twitching stuff. Although her heart raced as fast as ever and seemed to pinball off her ribs even as it jumped into her throat, Bibi told herself that if she had wished the creature to come out of the book, she could wish it away just as easily. In fact, that was what she had to do. Dispatching it was her duty, her responsibility. She slid under the covers once more, half sitting up against the pile of pillows, and she thought hard about the not Cookie, picturing it crawling back to the book on the floor, slithering in among the pages, melting away into the illustration from which it had arisen. For almost an hour, there were silences, periodically broken by new spasms from the creature. She was dry-mouthed and dizzy with wishing, with imagining. When eventually the horrid thing fell into a longer silence, she assumed that she had at last succeeded. She lay stone still, listening. Second by second, minute by minute, she became more encouraged, though if her heart thumped not quite so fast as before, it beat harder. Yet again, quiet ended. The thing scrabbled along a nearby wall. The lamp cord rattled against the back of the nightstand. If not by any of the usual five senses, the grisly little beast seemed to be finding its way to her by a sixth. She expected it to ascend to the top of the nightstand, 2 feet from her face. Then it moved under the bed and became quiet once more. She had been wrong about it being brainless. It could think, all right. Think and know and want and seek. In the silence of the room, the only sound was within Bibi, the frantic pump in her breast, which beat her into a strange submission, into a kind of paralysis. She could almost hear, too, the creature scheming in the darkness under the box spring. She would never know how it progressed from beneath the bed and under the covers without her hearing it or sensing its movement. When it touched her bare foot, she threw aside the blanket and the top sheet, her scream no more than a dry whistle in her throat. So it came to this. The confrontation of creator and created. In the dim light of the 5-watt Mickey lamp, Bibi bending forward, seizing the thing with both hands, peeling it off her ankle. Cold, but not slimy. Throbbing irregularly. Torsional. Difficult to hold. Her heart booming, quaking her entire body. Breath fast and shallow and ragged. She wished it away. Wished so hard that a headache split her skull. Her ears popped as though from a change in air pressure, and a capillary burst in her nose, unraveling a thread of blood out of her left nostril. Yet the would-be best friend escaped her grip, twisting and flopping up her chest toward her head. They were face to face when she seized it again, and the chocolate drop eyes were not gentle or kind or chocolate, but wet holes in which pooled some thick, oily substance that she thought must be all the hatred in the world boiled down to just 2 spoonfuls. Open-mouthed, the thing bent its flat face closer, closer, as if to suck out her breath of life. Migraine sawing through her skull, a blood haze tinting her vision, Bibi dug her fingers into the creature's yielding flesh and didn't wish it away anymore, but commanded it to be gone. This abomination that she had imagined into existence. To emphasize her authority, she punctuated her command by spitting upon the thing. It relented. And as it stopped struggling and diminished in her hands, she heard the pages of the book thrashing somewhere in the gloom, as the thing that was not Cookie nevertheless returned to Cookie's world. When Bibi's hands were empty, the book gave out one last rustle, and a hush fell upon the room. When she could find the strength to reach toward the nightstand lamp, she switched it on. The light was glorious. She wished morning would come to the window hours ahead of schedule. Just then, there couldn't be too much light. She leaned back against the pillows and the headboard. Blood trickled from one nostril, tears from both eyes. She thought she would throw up. She didn't. She thought her heart would never stop sledgehammering, but it returned slowly to a more gentle beat. For a long time, she sat in a kind of catatonia, not because she couldn't move or speak, but because she didn't want to move or speak, wondering, worrying about what new thing might be called into the world by a thoughtless gesture or one wrong word. In time, she slept. Morning came. She woke, she showered, she ate breakfast. She was quieter than usual, which her parents noted, but her mind was racing as always. Bobbin and spindle and flyer working at high speed, spinning woolly thoughts into taut threads, into ideas and speculations. Before her 6th birthday, her life had changed dramatically, irrevocably. and there was nothing to be done other than to accept what she was now. And be cautious. Never again wish into the world something that wasn't natural to it. Stories were good. They made life better, happier. But stories should remain between the covers of a book. Chapter 124. The Captain and His Albatross. Pack stood watching numbers roll up on the tape counter and the twin hubs turning as tape moved through the guide rollers. He didn't listen as closely to the captain's words as did Murphy and Nancy, for he'd heard them in the car with Pogo and would never forget them. As the magnetized strip of acetate spooled from reel to reel, paying out the past, he felt it pulling him toward the future. He wondered, with a reverent awe but also with some apprehension, what the years ahead with Bibi would be like, this remarkable woman, if she survived to share her life with him. During Captain's account, room 456 seemed to emerge from the building in which it had been located, like a bubble from a bubble blower's loop, becoming a world unto itself, afloat, so that if one were to open the door, no hospital corridor would wait beyond, but instead, an intolerable nothingness. His voice grew as mesmerizing as the drug that he'd put in young Bibi's Coca-Cola. In spite of the outlandish nature of the story he told, none in his audience of four expressed disbelief, because they knew now of other instances when Bibi's imagination had shaped her life for better. Jasper, who was renamed Olaf. Or worse, the writing assignment for Dr. Solange St. Croix. At one point, Nancy needed a chair, and Murphy brought one bedside for her. Throughout, the girl lay apparently insensate to this world, living in a different one of her vivid imagining. After recalling for Bibi the incident in her bedroom, which he had helped her to forget, the captain recounted how she had brought the creature out of the storybook again, this time in the kitchen of his apartment above the garage, to prove the truth of her claim. That experience had been terrifying for both of them, though less so for Bibi, because she had once vanquished the thing and knew that she had power over it. Speaking now from the cassette recorder as from the grave, the captain said,
"Bibi, considering that you lived with that secret for 8 months before you shared it with me, and considering that you were haunted by what had happened and were fearful of what you might unwittingly conjure up next, I still think the best solution was the memory trick. There are no coincidences. I came into your life with the knowledge necessary to heal you, protect you, and I believe that I was meant to do just that."
Getting up from her chair, as if her father stood in the room to be confronted, Nancy said, "Drugs? Hypnosis? Brainwashing?" But then she seemed to resign herself to the situation as it was, and sat once more, still weak-kneed, as the captain continued.
"You have such a powerful imagination, so colorful and detailed and deep. In time, I saw it was a gift, an extraordinary gift. I think you're born to tell stories, Bibi. That's a wonderful thing. I've read more truth in fiction than in nonfiction, partly because fiction can deal with the numinous, and nonfiction rarely does. The human heart and spirit, the unknown, the unknowable. Storytelling can heal broken hearts and damaged minds. As a writer, Bibi, you could be a doctor of the soul. I began to worry that with the memory trick, I stole from you part of your precious gift, denied you the chance to control it and to become all that you might be. So I began collecting quotations from famous writers, their thoughts about the great value of imagination. A foolish exercise? God, I hope not. Over the years, as I'm sure you remember, we talked a lot about those quotations. And in my fumbling way, I tried to make sure that you would develop your gift, that the knowledge lost to you regarding the full extent of your talent, the knowledge burned away with the memory trick, wouldn't prevent you from becoming all that you could be.
Chapter 125. In a World of Her Own Making.
In my fumbling way, I tried to make sure you would develop your gift, that the knowledge lost to you regarding the full extent of your talent would not prevent you from becoming all that you could be.
Bibi had crawled out of the knee-hole. She stood in the reception hall, a small figure in the vastness of white quartz, staring up at the circle of red stone and the two stylized lightning bolts centered in it. Over the years, she had been troubled by a repetitive nightmare in which two robed and hooded figures, tall and shambling, deformed in limbs and spines, had carried a corpse wrapped in a shroud. Under a Cheshire moon, they brought the dead man through the brick-paved courtyard behind the bungalow as she watched them from a window, terrified by their intent. They were, of course, returning Captain to the apartment above the garage, where he had died. How strange the mind is, she thought now. How it shrouds from itself some of its darker capacities. In the dream, one of the transporters of the dead became aware of her and turned its hooded head toward her bedroom window. Just then, the night always brightened, and she could see the countenance of death for a moment before he turned away. That glimpse frightened her to such an extent she did not, could not, would not carry the image with her when she woke. But now she remembered. Within the hood had been not a stripped bare skull, not a rotting countenance acrawl with worms and beetles, but only her face. Pale and set in a look of grim determination. Hooded death hadn't brought the captain home from the grave. 10-year-old Bibi, his loving granddaughter, she wanted so badly to resurrect him. Dreaming, she'd intuited the formidable power of her imagination, of which she'd no recollection when awake, the power having been burned away. For all his doubts, Captain had been right to use the memory trick. In spite of the hideous experience with the gingerbread man, she wouldn't have been able to resist the compulsion to bring the captain back. In fact, she understood now that in the weeks following his death, while visiting his apartment, she had unwittingly brought him out of the grave more than once, in the condition of an animated corpse, had brought him back and sent him away without any conscious awareness of what she was doing. The footsteps in other rooms, the wet blood dripping off his bedroom doorknob, the ominous presence in the apartment attic which stepped out of shadow into light. Those had been brief, half-realized resurrections. Had she been aware that she could affect his return with her imagination, she would have brought him back in full, and the horror of what she'd done would have destroyed her. When the golden retriever, Olaf, had died 6 years after her grandfather's passing, the memory trick must have begun to fail. Captain had been wrong to believe that traumatic experiences were burned away forever. They were instead flushed into a deep memory hole, there to fester until some stressful circumstance drew them toward the surface. Bibi had wanted to witness the dog's cremation, to be sure that he had been reduced to ashes. And she hadn't kept a twist of his fur, as she had kept the lock of hair and scrap of scalp from the captain's body. Whether consciously or unconsciously, she had been afraid that she would bring him back, imagine him with her again. Inevitably, he would have been a strange and menacing version of the dog she had loved. In spite of Olaf being only an urn full of ashes, she had yearned for reanimation. After spending 3 days locked in her room alone, struggling against the reckless love that would have led to resurrection, She had, in desperation, used the memory trick once more. As Pax switched off the recorder and picked it up from the bed, Bibi opened her eyes. He breathed her name, but she didn't look directly at him. Her gaze traveled right to left, left to right, alighting on no one, taking in everyone and everything, or nothing. She closed her eyes and remained unresponsive. When Bibi turned from the red circle and the black bolts of lightning, the immense white reception hall and another white room had for a moment been integrated. 10 feet away stood a hospital bed, an array of associated monitors, an IV drip. Nancy, Murphy, Pogo, and beautiful Paxton were gathered around the bed, their attention focused on the patient, who was Bibi herself. She understood at once what this vision meant, that it wasn't, in fact, a vision in the paranormal sense, that it was the truth of her condition, a revelation made by herself to herself, inspired by the captain speaking from beyond the grave. She wasn't surprised that she existed in two worlds simultaneously and in two conditions. In the deepest recesses of mind and heart, she had known all along.